to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to the Canadian Philosophy Show. I'm your main host for today, Tegan Marshall, out of VIU, and I'm here with our good friend, Aaron Wang, who is a VIU alumni. How are you doing tonight, Aaron?
I'm doing pretty good. I think this will be an interesting topic you've chosen for tonight.
And you, listeners, might be wondering, what is that topic? And I'm here to tell you that topic is how sociology and philosophy interact, but more specifically, what are the philosophical underpinnings of sociology? And so to begin, you must know something, that aside from philosophy and liberal studies, sociology is kind of my bag. I enjoy all the social sciences, so it's an exciting time to talk about this. And I know Aaron has some questions, but before we jump into that, let me just give you a brief background and understanding of what sociology is and what philosophy is. We'll start with philosophy. So philosophy is the breakdown of two Greek words, those being philos and sophia, which are often understood as the love of wisdom. But as a professor of mine, Dr. James Atkinson at VIU, has described it and accepts the following definition as well, that philosophy can be understood as the pursuit of wisdom. So philosophy is the pursuit of wisdom. It is also a method to acquire wisdom, as you've heard us talk about. And it is this pursuit of wisdom that leads us to want to understand things, obviously. And so in philosophy's development, obviously we could have stayed with ourselves the entirety of our existence, but that would not move society forward. So we continue to see our lives and the world around us within society. And this is what brought about the development of sociology, and particularly a concept that is important to understand, which is the sociological imagination. So this is the first kind of philosophical pin of sociology is C.S. Mill's term of the sociological imagination. What does that mean? That's a fair question that you might be asking. For those of you who have never heard that term, you can basically understand the sociological imagination as understanding how our experiences, and perspectives of society and being in society impact our personal situations, how society at large impacts the way we view those challenges, the way we see them, and the way we address them. And the sociological imagination is being able to take the four main theories of sociology that we often talk about and apply them to the challenges that we may experience in our lives, whether that is personal or in relationship to society at large. But before I go on a definition rampage, I want to see what Aaron's questions are.
Well, I guess I'll start kind of with a comment that I was talking about a little bit before we started the show. And that's, I think, generally speaking, people, when they think about the relationship between philosophy and sociology, normally kind of say that, okay, I understand that before sociology existed, there was philosophy. And philosophy encompassed basically all the things that came before sociology. There's some talk about politics, some talk about how to organize societies. There's talk about moral philosophies, types of rules that you should have for societies. What are just rules? What are good rules? What are not good rules? What are the roles of certain individuals in societies? Should there be certain classes in the society? Should there not be certain classes in the society? So there are all of those ideas that are present in recorded history before the field that we call sociology came to exist, which, if I'm correct, basically came to exist in the 20th century. But I think it's, in the modern context, it's important to think about not just how philosophy shaped the rise of sociology, but how sociology now shapes the role of philosophy today. So that's what I'm hoping we can dive into, because I think that's an interesting question that I haven't heard covered before. So I'm interested to dive deeper into that.
So let's form that in a question versus a very long concept. Basically, what Aaron is suggesting or asking is, how does sociology actually impact philosophy versus philosophy being the birthplace of sociology? So we think that sociology is just influenced by philosophy, when in reality, one could, and I agree, make the argument that philosophy is also heavily influenced by sociological theories and personal experiences. And so to get there, I think it's important to lay out what the four main theories of sociology are, and then we can talk about both ways. We can talk about how philosophy led to the rise of sociology, and we can talk about how sociology actually, whether we acknowledge it or not, because I will take the position that a lot of our philosophy is impacted by sociological ideas without our knowledge. We don't parse those out, but they're there. So let me just quickly give you an overview of the four theories, and then Aaron and I will get into a heated discussion about the question at hand. So the first and earliest kind of sociological theory is called functionalism. And functionalism, as the name implies, sought to observe the way that people operated and functioned in society. And that came down to relationships as well. What do employer and employee relationships add to society? How does that impact the view and relationships we have in society? But it was a strictly very much, there is one objective reason this functions in society, let's parse that out. And I'm not saying that's a bad place. That's a great place to begin. But as we know, personal experience plays deeply into sociological thought, because all of society is made up of personal experiences that are then shared and worked with and grappled with together to some extent. So then we got the symbolic interactionist movement. And the symbolic interactionist movement kind of is one of the most philosophical movements to suggest that it's not just, we shouldn't be looking at and understanding just how something functions within society, what benefit it gives society. Rather, we should be surveying and observing people as they interact with those things and see how that impacts their life. For example, I am taking a course I just started this week on the social determinants of health. And so versus understanding what role the healthcare system just plays in society, understanding how individuals relate with healthcare and then how that shapes their life, right? So seeing the personal experiences that help define and maybe challenge our perceptions of what health and healthcare is by extension. So it's all about how we gain information, how we gain experience, and ultimately how we gain meaning from relationships, social structures, and even objects within society. How does that impact us as people? And how does that help us to grow or actually hinder us from doing so. And then we get to the more recent additions. I say recent in terms of the discipline, but again, not necessarily recent in experience. We come to the conflict theory view, which suggests that the power structures in society create conflict and challenges, and we should be surveying and looking at those challenges and looking for ways to overcome those challenges to bring about better equality, better security, and overall trying to benefit particularly the working class, because this is highly influenced by Karl Marx thinking and work. And then in addition to the final theory that we're going to look at, it is the feminist theory, the theory of the feminist movement that really sought to look at how women impact society, sought to make known the contributions and the actual impact of having women in the workforce, for example, to bring in those voices to strengthen the sociological discipline to understand perhaps some unique experiences that women do have and have had in society, to give us a broader understanding of life within particularly a Western civilization framework. So I've very briefly outlined all of those theories, and I will be upfront with the audience and say that I'm a pretty strong symbolic interactionist, partially because of my disability, that desire and that need to draw deeper meaning from relationships in particular, to help me grow more and help me move forward, has just been a major part of my life. But I see value in all these theories, because all these theories bring an important piece of the puzzle to understanding, not just understanding social structures and social construction, which is a very multifaceted issue, but it helps us understand that there are individuals with all these experiences within society. And so to have that diverse understanding is particularly helpful when we start to get into the philosophical underpinnings and whether sociology impacts our political political and philosophical investigations. Did any of that make any sense?
Yeah, I think you made a pretty clear picture that there's four main theories. Out of curiosity, is that the chronological order in which they emerged, roughly speaking?
I can't guarantee for sure. Every textbook that I've received has listed them in that exact manner. So I would assume that is pretty chronologically accurate.
Well, I guess that's a little bit beside the point. I am interested in kind of the underpinnings of functionalism. It does sound like that would have a lot in common with utilitarianism, which we've talked about before on the show. The kind of the idea that you should judge something as whether it is ethical or good based off of the utility of the act or the utility of the decision. So essentially, like, those are the things that are the most important is individuals' happiness and the effective results of decisions, the effective consequences of decisions. It does seem to me that functionalism would be, then that theory would be very compatible with utilitarianism.
It is a very utilitarian view. I think especially as sociology developed, there was this very strong desire to just understand what an object or a concept brought to society. And so it was like, okay, how can we utilize this to understand something? And got to be careful with my words here, because I don't know for sure whether Emile Durkheim was a hardcore functionalist, but an example of functionalism, well, yes, functionalism, but also symbolic interactionism, is his study on social cohesion, his study on what it meant to have unity within a society. But as I say that, I'm realizing that that's just by nature more symbolic interactionist, so I'll come back to that. But basically to say, a good example of this is institutions. What does the university bring to society? What does that offer from a functionalist perspective? It offers training to enter a trade or discipline. That's what it offers. That's its function. And that would be strictly how a functionalist would view it. I don't believe they would make necessarily moral judgments in terms of the entirety of the theory, but they would say this is how it functions and leave that to the sociological community to determine whether that was a benefit or not.
Yeah, I am struggling a little bit. So I've heard in the past, and I'm not sure how true this is, that sociology kind of arose out of psychology to kind of like bring some of the ideas of psychology into the study of groups rather than the study of individuals. Is that accurate, or is that kind of just a myth that keeps propagating itself?
Well, I think whether it's true or not, it's true in practice. To understand where psychology tries to seek and understand the internal workings of a person or even a collective group, sociology strives to bring the outside impact of that to the forefront of discussion. So and that's more, I would say, where symbolic interactionism lies, because you're dealing with both the internal reality and the external implication. So as I was talking about earlier, there's a famous sociological study done by Emile Durkheim. If you want to look this up, audience, all you have to do is look up Emile Durkheim and his study on suicide. He's known as one of the first sociologists, so there you go. He may actually be a functionalist. But what he observed was the role of social cohesion. The level of social unity, social cohesion, social community a person had that shared the same values and beliefs, the lower the suicide rate went. The more division and diversity in that, the suicide rate went up. And this is interesting because, as we were talking about today in class, one of the things that we are observing and is pretty active right now in sociological research is the idea of social isolation and what role that plays, not just on individuals, but on society. And so I would say that is true, because where, as I stated before, where psychology looks inwardly to understand a person's inner working and thought process, sociology seeks to observe that in a more measurable scale on a collective outward implication process, which is exactly what Emile Durkheim's study on suicide accomplished, to try and explain what a individual phenomenon, what an individual experienced, how that then led to social and social impact.
Yeah, and I don't know really anything for sure about these things. I'm not trained in these fields, but I think it's a very common perspective today to say that we live in a very individualistic culture, to say that that has a lot of consequences in terms of social isolation, that, you know, we teach people that to be a good person in Western society, you know, you have to be an independent person. You have to pay your own bills, live in your own house, have your own dog, and preferably your own vehicle. And so there's these ideas that, you know, a contributing full member of society is someone who operates as independently and as self-sufficiently as possible, which seems the exact opposite as of a society that values social cohesion. If you value strong, meaningful relationships, then how do you balance that with the need and the desire for individuals to be themselves? So, I mean, I don't really have a strong answer to that, but I do think it's something that, well, we're just exploring as a society right now. And I think that you can see that, in the technologies we've created recently. Like, if you look at the most successful technologies like Netflix, Amazon, Facebook, it's a lot of these technologies are taking the things that a society is supposed to do, trade, entertainment, socializing, and making them more individually convenient, easier to do, but also more, at the same time, more standardized, more robotic, more machine-like. And it's very strange, because it's like, while on the one hand, you can say that there's a lot of social cohesion in the West, because you can just look at all of the activity on all the social platforms, and you can see, you know, people are liking each other and happy, and there's so many people who have so many friends and so many people who are connected to each other through all of these digital networks. But then if you look at the people in general, you know, now they belong to five or six social networks. They go to a whole bunch of different classes. They know hundreds of people, but they don't necessarily have a deep, meaningful connection or a strong social cohesion with a small group of people.
I think that brings me back to something I talked about a number of weeks ago, even months ago, on a show where I talked about the difference between society-given identities and the fact that we as individuals give identity to society. That it is in every individual person's action, good or bad, that impacts a society. And I think that's key, because in this world of technology, although being a person with a disability, I can really come to love and appreciate and admire technological advancement. It does not do the same thing for me on a personal level as good old-fashioned in-person interaction does, because you are not in the same space, you are not occupying the same space, you're not, you know, it's interesting, because this is where the philosophy of that comes in, I think, is that you have a society which or not even a society. Let's go a little smaller and say you have a community. What makes that community so special to you is the memories that are formed, the relationships that are made, and the learning and experience you take away from that, as much as it is what you can contribute in time and energy and contribution. And I think, or at least I observed this during COVID, even though I was with my family and I love them, they're great, there was still that longing for a broader community, especially as we were all in the midst of spending a lot of time at home for valid reasons. I think it's going to be interesting to see how technology kind of redefines a society as that almost gets more and more individualistic, to having to really redefine what the philosophy of world is in that case, because ultimately a society, although you may not be directly interacting with someone, you're naturally, from a philosophical perspective, part of the world of that society, because you live in those communities, you ascribe to mostly the same ideas, and you just spend time there. So it's going to be an interesting transition for sure. But unless Aaron, you have something to add to that, should we move to how sociology actually impacts our philosophical perspectives? But I'll give you room for a concluding comment or two.
Yeah, I do think that, well, we did, Hale and I, one of our other good friends and colleagues on the show, did a show on effective altruism a while ago. And that's a philosophical movement that kind of arose out of some utilitarian grounds, basically saying that the work that charities did was not always effective. So even though there were some organizations that had some very good intent, they weren't always using their resources in what was deemed the most effective way. And so we talked about several examples. The classic example is the pond example. So there's someone drowning in a pond. And then the question is, well, should you save the person drowning in the pond? Well, obviously the ethical thing to do is just to save them. But what if the person is super far away and then you have to, you know, someone phones you and says, okay, you have to spend $10. And if you spend this $10, then I will save this person drowning in the pond over here. And so if you get that type of phone call, it's a very different interaction than if you see something happening in front of you and you just have a split second decision about whether or not you're going to act and save the person in front of you. So we talked a lot of the complexities. It's one of the favorite shows I've gotten to do, mainly because it helped me understand that just because something seems like it's obviously the right thing to do socially doesn't mean that it's always necessarily the correct thing. Sometimes that there are some complexities or contextual nuances that can make things very difficult, especially when we start talking about rules and guidelines that involve millions of people or nations on different sides of the globe.
What? You mean there's nuance to these situations? And it's not just about the function of doing an ethical action, and therefore rendering functionalism maybe not the best approach when it comes to ethical decisions?
Well, it is.
What?
I mean, I don't know very much about functionalism, so I'll have to take your word for that. But the main point that I'm trying to get to here is that it seems like, in general, philosophy used to kind of have these very simplistic logical rules. And it's just like, okay, well, if we just follow the logic and reason it out, then there's, you know, something we can do that's according to nature, that's according to the good instincts of the good human. And if we just do that, then, you know, we'll have a perfect world. And I think part of the challenge or the reason sociology was invented was because people were like, well, good intentions take us a long way, but they're not going to help us when there's a problem that can't be solved necessarily by good intentions alone.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think that's true. I think what you're saying is that philosophy although has general principles that it tries to follow and employ. I mean, that's the entirety of Kant's ethical theory, is what are the universalizable principles?